Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
All right. No further foolishness here. We are deep into the Varsity Blues, the scandal within the scandal. That's the name of the book. The author is John Wilson, and honestly, I was just asking our engineers in there, I'm like, did you guys know any of this? Yeah, no. We all missed it, John. We feel guilty and ashamed. We completely missed what happened to your family, and I'm really glad you're telling the story. So there's a little blurb in here from your, I'm sure it's from your publicist, probably. It says, John Wilson tells the shocking and untold story, backed by staggering evidence of how he became collateral damage by overreaching federal prosecutors who weaponized our justice system to satisfy bringing Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin, who were the two people we heard about all the time.
That's all you heard in the media.
To trial in Boston in the infamous Operation Varsity Blues case, and his ongoing battle against the federal government, Netflix, and USC to restore his family's honor. Honestly, they did a pretty good job of... I mean, did the media cover this at all, or were you just...
No. Unfortunately, the way the government can control the process, once you're charged and you're under trial and you're going through the process, you're not allowed to speak to the media. The judges say you're not going to try this in the court of public opinion. So the prosecutors can get out there and say what they want. And so every time someone was arrested, or if someone was pleading guilty, or someone was sentenced, or someone went to prison, they got their, you know, bullhorn out and started broadcasting it across, you know, the media. We couldn't say anything. We're not allowed to say anything by the judge. So for 5 years, we had to remain silent while they're just smearing us over and over again. And, you know, like anything, once the headline is out, you know, 5 years later, it's kind of an afterthought. Who's going to, you know, want to correct something? I'll give another example. Even in day one, in this case, when we were arrested, the Boston Globe had a front page cover story on this case, of course, and I was featured. I was a local man. I was featured, and they said I was already convicted of a previous felony for securities fraud or commodities trading fraud, something like that. I said, what? This is crazy.
Wow.
And they had the wrong John Wilson, right? They had a different John Wilson. They didn't even do their fact-checking, and they were trying to rush this story out. And so I'm smeared on the front page of the Boston Globe with not only being charged falsely in this case, but then falsely accused of being a felon for some other charges from years before. And so we said, this is the wrong thing. So, of course, they research it, and whatever, a week or two later, they put a correction on page, like, 32 as a footnote. Oh, yeah, by the way, John Wilson wasn't really convicted of something else. That was a mistake. And that's the way this whole process could work. They get the headlines month after month after month while this is all hot, and you're not allowed to say anything. And so, you know, 6 years later, I'm trying to correct the record for my children. You know, my career has been destroyed, but they still have 50 years of work ahead of them and a life ahead of them, and I want to do what I can. I think about my poor daughters for a second. They were 16 years old when this happened. 16 years old. Teenage girls, you know how vulnerable they are already to the normal social media pressures, right? Imagine having federal prosecutors say you're cheaters, that you're basically accusing you of cheating and being unqualified, and you get a perfect score, a near-perfect score, and they're going to top schools, high schools, and highly qualified in every way. One of my daughters was captain of the water polo team at her school, and they were both swimmers, and they did all kinds of sports, basketball and volleyball and so forth. And so they're highly qualified, highly active, really smart, and they're being smeared, not by a bully from the school or some kind of, you know, rogue internet troll, but by federal prosecutors, right? And you're 16. How do you deal with that, right? It's been devastating and traumatizing for them. And my son wasn't, you know, much better off. He was 21. You know, 21-year-old man, who spent 10 years competing nationally and internationally in sports, was a high-caliber athlete, had a world record when he was younger, and played on the USC team. Now being called an alleged athlete. That's what the government still calls them to this day, an alleged athlete.
Wow.
They might as well be alleged human beings, right?
Yeah.
Alleged athlete. They know the truth, and they still smeared my children that way, and it's just despicable. So I'm fighting to get the record corrected for them, you know, more than myself, but it's been devastating. I not only have to spend $11 million in legal fees, which is an enormous amount of money. I had to deplete all my life savings. I was successful, but I had to spend every penny. I've lost my job for 7 years at the peak of my career, because once you're charged with these felonies, and even if with the remaining tax conviction, you can't can't get a job in a corporate America role.
Yeah, nobody wants you running their company while you're wearing a jumpsuit.
Right, or even if you're just accused and
you've been fitted for one.
Yeah.
Right. Just the accusation alone is enough to scare people because, again, the government's conviction rate is 99.6%.
So why would they bring a case if you didn't do it, right?
Well, that's how most people think as well. They must have something or they wouldn't prosecute him.
Exactly. No one thinks there's nefarious motivations. I think people are getting more sensitive to that now when they see how prosecutors can weaponize the justice against somebody like the president for political reasons or other people. So they're seeing how the weaponization of justice can be a reality. And it's not just political reasons, but there are other people like myself for career reasons. There may be vendettas. There may be other reasons. But I'm convinced that there's a lot of innocent people out there who didn't have the resources. And so as painful and as horrific as this has been, I'm actually still feeling somewhat blessed. I had the resources to fight. I had the willpower and the grit from my tough upbringing to fight. And I had the support of family and friends and our faith to fight. Most people don't have any of those three things. So I'm blessed in a lot of ways, even though this has been painful. I was able to fight. Most people can't. And they just get railroaded and they're sitting in prison and sometimes for years and years for a crime they didn't commit.
Yeah, that's the scary part. You know, when your justice system, you know, weaponizes the process against people, you do have a lot of innocent people that are behind bars because they couldn't defend themselves against the machine, you know, I'm hoping that's getting turned around now. I mean, we're hearing stories now of a lot of these folks going out the door, but stories like yours need to really be told so people know the extent of what went on in our justice system. It's crazy.
It is. You step back and say, okay, what some of these other parents did was wrong. Cheating on tests is absolutely wrong. Is it a federal felony that deserves prison time?
Yeah.
I don't think so, personally. Or putting a fake profile, putting a picture of your kid sitting on a rowing machine and photoshopping that like other parents did. I didn't do that. That's wrong. Is that a federal felony?
Yeah, probably not.
Those kind of things are crazy. Yeah, but that's what they charge. Everybody had a felony charge. They said, we're not going to lower anybody's charges below felony if you plead guilty. So everyone in this case had to plead guilty to a felony. And the Boston prosecutors look at it as just more scalps on a belt that could boost their careers. Mm. And that's the despicable part of this, right? It's so disproportionate to anything that's realistic. When you think about, like you said, some people who might be murdering and doing other bad acts, getting far less. But, you know, cheating on a test is now a federal felony. It's kind of crazy how disproportionate things are.
So this all, you know, this kicks off, right? They put you in prison and scare you, and then how long until you eventually are heard in court?
It takes about 2 years. Yeah, once 2021.
So it just hangs over your head for 2 years.
For 2 years, and they keep piling on charges in the meantime. So literally every 3 months they pile on another charge to try to pressure me to plead guilty. They charge me far more than anyone else, right? They kept piling on charge after charge for me because they wanted me to plead guilty because I had facts that proved I was innocent, right? So they didn't want me to go to trial at all. But they got a judge who blocked all my facts, so that was really the terrible thing that happened in my case. But they didn't want me to go to trial, so they kept piling on more charges. The average parent got one or two charges. I got nine. I was lucky, right? Nine charges they piled on me to pressure me to plead guilty. You know, so no one else had. Even the ringleader, Rick Singer, only had three felonies. So they just kept piling on and piling on. I'll tell you, the other thing was just another shocking little side story. And the book has about 50 shocking stories in it. Again, I would encourage your audience to read it. You know, Varsity Blues, The Scandal Within the Scandal. All the proceeds go to charity, not to me, but I want our story out there to correct the record. But the first day I'm in Boston for court, right? We're in court to plead guilty, enter our plea agreement. And there's 50 people that are there, right? You have all these parents. Felicity Huffman's there. Lori Loughlin's there. Everybody flies in from California. We're the local people. We just drove down from our house in the suburbs. So we're all there. The media throngs are crazy, right? This is a sensationalized story. And, you know, people are shoving microphones and cameras in your faces. It's horrible walking through that gauntlet of the media outside the courthouse. So we get in and we all plead not guilty. But everybody else has to go home. They have to catch a flight. They're all flying back to California. My wife and I said, look, we're going to sit back, let the media die down, because we're just driving home. We can drive an hour later. It doesn't really matter. So we just decide to stay. We told our lawyer to leave. You know, we don't want to pay you very expensive rates. An hour to babysit us while we wait for the media to die down. So we go home. We'll stay by ourselves. We stay by ourselves. Everybody's gone. The media's still there, but it's about half what it was. We said, okay, let's go home now. It's like 4 o'clock. Let's drive home now. My wife decides to go to the restroom, and we're in the hallway of the courthouse on the ground floor waiting. They're just outside the entrance there. And as I'm waiting for her, the prosecutor, the lead prosecutor, comes up to me. And he approaches her talking. He says, hey, you know, if you plead now, I can get you a deal that'll exclude from the whatever the rating factors, whatever he called it, the money you committed but didn't donate yet. And so we'll get you a lesser prison sentence. I said, what? I said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm not going to plead guilty. I didn't do anything wrong. And then I said to him, and besides, isn't it against the rules?
Yeah.
For you to be talking to me without my lawyer here?
Right. I even learned that on Law and Order.
My wife starts walking up from the bathroom, and he sees her and gets a little panicked. I said that to him, and you know what his response was? It was a smug response that just still makes my blood boil to this day. He smirks at me and says, who do you think makes up the rules? Right? Think about the arrogance of that.
Wow.
Say that in a federal courthouse. Who do you think makes up the rules? Who do you think makes the rules for every shit like that? Like, what? I told my lawyer that happened that night, right? I said, he said, look, you can't do anything about it. It'd be your word against his. And by the way, you know, you're an accused felon and he's a federal prosecutor, so they're not going to believe you. So that's just the way they can do things. I said, really? That's our system? And that was just the lead off within Boston. That was my first experience with the Boston prosecutors. This is when I came back from Texas. And that's how they just kick off this whole process, right? They are smug and arrogant. And who do you think makes the rules? Really? That's how the system of justice is being run? They can make up the rules and break them, you know, whatever they want as it suits their needs. And they did that over and over and over in this process, blocking evidence, destroying evidence. They admitted on the stand that Singer destroyed thousands and thousands of his texts to people. Crazy stuff like that, right? And, you know, the stuff they did on evidence, hiding evidence, blocking evidence, was atrocious, but the judge approved it all, and the judge kept saying to us in the trial, take it up on appeal. I'll never forget, we were giving all of our evidence, trying to give our evidence. He blocked it 660 times. At the end, towards the end of the trial, the judge said, how much more evidence do you have? And we were entering things into what's called an offer of proof, because we knew we were going to lose. We had to put it into the trial record so that we could bring it to the appeals court. He said, how much more do you have? It's going to be like another 60 pieces, what the lawyer said. He said, well, I'm going to dismiss it all en masse. En masse? What do you mean on that? You don't even know what it is. Doesn't matter. I'm dismissing it all en masse. It's like a railroad. It was like a Russian show trial. I'm dismissing the rest of your evidence en masse. Oh, great. Thanks. You know, he kept saying, take it up on appeal. It's like, how is this a fair process?
Was your attorney surprised at this, or was
they were
like...
Shocked. They were flabbergasted.
Oh, okay.
It was just unbelievable. They were totally shuffled. You can't do anything about it. Once you're in the courtroom,
yeah.
The judge is the supreme authority. You can't do anything. And so you have to lose and then go to the appeals court. That's all you can do, and spend another $1 million on an appeal or $2 million on your appeal. Right? That's the process. Mm-hmm. The judge is the ultimate authority, and once you get a judge who's basically doing the bidding of the prosecutor, you know, he approves their motions 98.3%. You basically have nothing to do. You can't do anything to defend yourself. He blocks all your evidence. He lets other people in. So they let other people in who had nothing to do with us. So I had parents on the stand talking about, oh, everybody knew Singer was, you know, bribing coaches. I didn't know. How do you know me? You don't even ought to know Mr. Wilson, but, you know, I knew of him or whatever. I was in his town. One guy says, I was in Mr. Wilson's house once for a fundraiser. Okay, yeah. Did you ever talk to Mr. Wilson? No. But then the jury hears, oh, he knows Mr. Wilson. He's in my house. Well, yeah, he was in my house for a fundraiser with 50 other people or 100 other people. Okay, but I never talked to him. I don't know this guy. And they act like we were best friends. And, you know, everybody knew. Everybody didn't know. You might have known, but you can't speak for me. You know, and by the way, did Steve Jobs know? We couldn't bring other clients in of Singers, you know. So they can just smear you like that. And the dirty tactics at the trial, the dirty tactics in the courtroom, the dirty tactics in the motions were just horrific. I'll give you another example. This will make some of your audience members probably blood boil, too. They took all of my emails from, like, 10 years, not just the Singer emails. They violated the search warrant. They took all of our private family emails. So I had pictures of my children from family vacations, my daughters at 12 years old wearing bikinis, And they shared that with 150 lawyers. And we tried to get the judge to pull that down from the website that was being shared, but they said, nope, got to keep it out there. That's what you get for being accused of this crime. You have to have all your stuff like that. My kids' medical records, there's no HIPAA law protection once you're accused. So HIPAA law goes out the window. Your medical records, all your medical records are exposed to all these lawyers involved in this case. Your children, imagine my twin daughters. My wife said, this is so creepy. Who knows if one of these guys is a pedophile, right? So my twin daughters, 12 years old, wearing bikinis, is being shared with 150 lawyers. Really? That's necessary as part of this trial? And we appealed to the judge. We begged the judge to take it down. He said, absolutely not. You know, that's got to remain out there. It's like, what? That's how vicious this process can be. And my wife was just sick to her stomach thinking about, you know, is there a pedophile looking at this stuff? My son, too. My son was also in swimsuits as well. You know, who knows? It could be a male pedophile, too, for a man. But, you know, having your teenage kids in swimsuits from private family photos and our own emails back and forth.
That had nothing to do with, I mean, the value of that in this particular case was zero, obviously.
Oh, it was just to destroy you emotionally and otherwise, right? And just to put more pressure on you.
Mm. Damn.
They would do that over and over and over throughout this process, right? Every time they had a chance, they would just try to stick it to you. And I also took polygraph tests. I volunteered. I took polygraph tests with the head of the FBI polygraph division, the former head, and separately quality controlled by the head of the CIA polygraph division, who ran the polygraph school for 10 years for the entire federal government. The real deal. You don't get any higher than these guys. The world's best polygraph experts. I took 2 days of polygraph tests, more than they've ever done for anyone in their history. So I never had a guy take 22 questions or whatever. I took 22 questions every aspect of this case. I passed them all with flying colors because I wanted to prove my innocence. I did this because we had 2 years before the trial. I said, what if I die of a heart attack because of all the stress? I said, I want the truth to be recorded. So I volunteered, took these polygraph tests. Yeah, I took these polygraph tests. Now this time I'm 61 now waiting for this thing. And I passed them all. We actually submitted those, gave those to Netflix before the movie came out, and said, look, we know you're doing a movie. We don't know who's going to be in it, but in case Mr. Wilson's in it, we gave them a 550-page letter that had all of our facts that were in the public record, including some of the stuff that wasn't, like these polygraph results. And we gave it to Netflix before the movie came out. They ignored it all and said, thank you, but we're going ahead with our movie. So the government had the polygraph test. So they knew I passed all these polygraph tests. And they use polygraphs all the time.
Sure.
But at a trial?
But they would only use it if it was bad. John, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, let's delve into this Netflix thing because, you know, people watch those and they think, I don't know what they think, but a lot of times people assume, well, you know, if it wasn't true, they wouldn't have made the movie about it.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Our guest is John Wilson. He is the author of Varsity Blues, The Scandal Within the Scandal. You should definitely get the book. You can find this interview later at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
I'm gonna do bad things, do it like it's nothing. Being bad has never felt so good. I'm gonna do bad things, you won't see. Doing bad things to you.
But the good news is there's angels everywhere out on the street, holding out a hand to pull you back up on your feet. The ones that you've been dragging for so long, you're on your knees, you might as well be praying. Guess what I'm saying? If you're going through hell, keep on going, don't slow down. If you're scared, don't show up.
That's a true story. John, so what happened with Netflix?
Well, Netflix was also culpable here. So they announced before my trial, about 6 months before my trial, they're going to release a documentary called Operation Varsity Blues or something like that. And so we were worried that they would include me in that. And so we sent them a warning letter. We said, in case you're including Mr. Wilson in your documentary, here are all the facts. We sent them real photos of my son. And you can see all this on a website as well. There's a website we have called thescandalwithinthescandal.com. But in the Netflix, you know, warning letter, we included all the government and public filings because our facts were very different. We were charged with the same thing, honest services fraud, but all the other allegations for the other parents were very different. The other parents were alleged to have cheated. We were never alleged to have cheated. The other parents were alleged to have created fake profiles for kids who didn't even play the sport. We didn't do that. The other parents were alleged to have bribed coaches. We didn't bribe a coach. Our money went to the school. So our allegations were very, very different. And what you show in a movie is not the charges, but the allegations. They depicted me as a parent who was photoshopping their kid in the pool. They had a guy photoshopping a kid standing in the shallow end of the pool, a small little wimpy kid. Nothing against that kid, but they had a little tiny kid, you know, what I used to call a piped arm kid. My son was the real deal, standing in the shallow pool with a water polo ball above his head. And at the beginning of the movie, they show that kid's face being photoshopped when my voice is going on, right? So they use my voice, and the way they can, you know, make movies is horrible. You can put my voice in a conversation with a singer that's recorded, just my actual words, but it's being shown or it's being aired when they're depicting some guy photoshopping a kid's head. We never photoshopped anything, right? So they can do that. Well, we just use your voice. Well, yeah, it's my voice, but I didn't do that, what you have shown there, right? So they did a lot of stuff like that. So we filed suit because they smeared me. We did some focus groups, you know, on the Netflix movie later and at the time. Later, we did a focus group, and everybody who watched the movie, who never seen it, didn't know me before, concluded I was the worst parent of any because they showed me or had my words, I think, 23 times in the first 20 minutes or so.
Oh, my God.
Right? So they had me as the guy they show again and again and again and again. So they think, by inference, I did all the bad things. They had other people cheating and bribing and faking. And my name and my voice is coming up again and again. So you think I did it all. And I didn't do any of it, right? But that's what people came away thinking.
And the point of that for them was, like, I get the prosecutors wanted notoriety and all that. Netflix was just getting views. I mean,
they were just leveraging the audience, the built-in audience. Right? They wanted to maximize dollars and eyeballs because this was a sensational case. And I had more audio and more calls with Singer than anybody. So they had, like, 11 phone calls for me. Again, I didn't say anything illegal in those phone calls, but they could take a soundbite out of context. I'll give you two or three things they did in addition to, like, these photoshopping things. I had a conversation with Singer, and he says to me towards the end, one of the very last conversations, don't meet with the schools, with the development office of the schools when you go out to Harvard or Stanford. And I said, okay, well, why not? They don't play that second half. I say, okay, and they just stop it there. I say, okay, why not? He says, because then they'll hit you up for more donations. Right? That's what he says. So they don't play the second half. They say, just the finger half, saying, don't go to the schools. When you go to the schools, you know, with your daughters, don't meet with the development officers. I say, okay. And that makes it like I've got some kind of nefarious intent here. And I ask, why not? And he says, because they'll hit you up for more donations. That's why you donated to his company in the first place, his foundation. So that kind of thing. Another example of what they did in the movie, which is just nefarious, is I'm trying to clarify how the money that I'm going to wire to him should go. And so I say to him, so I wired the money to you, not to the schools, right? And he says, yeah. And they end it there. Then they go to another parent talking about bribing coaches, right? And that's so misleading. It's crazy. Because then very next thing in my mouth, I say to him, and then you wired the money to the schools, right? Always trying to figure out, do I wire the money to the schools directly or do I wire it to you and then you wire it to the schools? Well, they drop the second half of that conversation again, take the soundbite out of context, and then they juxtapose it with another parent saying we're going to bribe the coaches. So all they hear from me is, I don't wire the money to you. I don't wire the money to the schools. I wire it to you. And then somebody else says, well, we'll bribe the coach of that money. And so it misleads you to think that that's what I'm doing too.
Holy cow.
And they do it over and over. So this is the thing that will just blow your mind, maybe. It blew my mind. It's probably the worst part of this whole case, worse than being in the prison. So we did this focus group before the trial, and we had about 30 people from Boston in this big facility designed to do this kind of thing. It's a big, like, open seating area with some presentations, and people can be, like, mock attorneys. And we're sitting behind a two-way mirror just watching and listening. I'll never forget, they started talking about the parents in this case. They were talking about me and other parents in this case. And one of the gentlemen who had a child who, I guess, didn't get into the colleges that they wanted, and I understand he's upset, and he said, you know what? These guys had all seen, or most of them had seen the Netflix movie. You know, I think these parents are worse than Hitler. worse than Hitler. He said, because
so Hitler.
They murdered every child in America's dreams for college, including my daughter, right? What?
Wow.
So now here's a guy calling me worse than Hitler because he's seen the Netflix movie because I had murdered every child's dreams for college. It's like, what is going on here? Because, again, I think people, and we're justifiably upset. If I had a child who didn't get into their school and Felicity Huffman or somebody else had a child that was not qualified, that made a bribe and did some other false statements in their, you know, applications, and they bumped my more qualified kid, I'd be mad too. Now, would I call the person Hitler? Probably not. But I understand the anger and the frustration. But imagine sitting behind a two-way mirror and having people talk about you in a focus group and say you're worse than Hitler because you murdered every child in America's dreams for college.
Jeez.
This is how crazy this case is getting, right?
Okay, were you just like, okay, I'm going to prison? Like that? I mean, that had to be like a super depressing day.
Oh, it was incredibly depressing. It's like, my God, how do you get out of that hole?
Yeah, right?
And then on top of it, you have a trial where the judge blocks all your evidence. Right? It's just because they cherry-picked the judge. They handpicked through judge shopping. And that's another process which is crazy. So what they can do is every judge gets assigned randomly, right? And that's good. Should be assigned randomly. I get that. That's great. But what they could do is they could sprinkle some cases. In the case of Boston, they had, let's say, a bunch of low-level cases. So the administrator worked for Singer, some coach over here, a test taker over there. They sprinkled a bunch of cases, and they all got assigned randomly to different judges. And then, I think there were only six or seven judges, federal judges in Boston. Then when they got the judge they wanted, they stopped. So they had, let's say, five different judges and cases assigned randomly. They covered the whole gamut. And then they amended that judge's docket, the judge that they wanted, and said, now we're going to make it one national conspiracy, and we're going to charge all these people as one part of one national conspiracy, and we're going to add it to this judge's docket. And so they can basically circumvent the random assignment process through that kind of judge shopping. Right? And then they got the judge they wanted, who ruled against us, et cetera, and made this the trial, kind of a farcical trial. But it's very rare to ever get an appeals court to overturn all your core convictions, right? They did that, and then they dropped all those charges because they knew that if I had a new random judge, there's no way they would have gotten away with all the stuff they did, you know, at that trial. So, you know, the process is so fundamentally flawed. We shared all this with Netflix. We even shared with the prosecutors. They got a copy of all my polygraph results that we gave to Netflix. But Netflix ignored it, and so did the prosecutor. In fact, at my first sentencing, when I was found guilty of everything before my appeal, they wanted me to get 14 months of prison time, more than anybody else. They said I was the worst parent by far. So they kept telling the judge and everybody, Mr. Wilson's the worst parent by far in this case. Right? They were just, that's why they piled on 9 felonies.
Were you considered like a ringleader? I mean, was this like you guys all worked together? Or
no, just because I had 3 children. Other people had 5 children involved and so forth, right? But they were just trying to characterize me as being the most evil guy because they said, why are you piling on 9 felonies against this guy?
Yeah.
Everybody's got 1 or 2, right? So they had to make some story up. Their narrative was, I was the worst parent by far. Even though my kids got a perfect score, my son played on the team, my money went to the school, they knew all this stuff, but they still had to characterize me as the worst parent. And, you know, at my sentencing, they said, well, we could admit the polygraph there, and they said, and the judge said, I'm not going to read it because it's self-serving, they said. The polygraph said, well, it's self-serving. Okay, it's self-serving. It's kind of crazy.
It's called a trial,
Yeah, it's self-serving, the polygraph test. So that's the kind of process they can run. I never took a polygraph in my life. I did it just because I wanted the truth to be there, and as I mentioned earlier, in case I died of a heart attack or something happened to me between, you know, when I was arrested and the trial, so I volunteered to take it. And, you know, none of that seemed to matter. The truth didn't matter to these guys. It was more about getting a conviction. Once they charge you and they falsely accuse me, they knew they had to try to cover that up by either getting me to plead guilty or to railroad me through a trial and get me convicted, because that would then, you know, make their actions look legitimate. And so they had to win a trial. They just railroaded me through a trial that was just outrageous in every way possible. And then they fought on the appeal as well. And I'll never forget, on the appeal side, we finally had 3 judges who were very capable, asking good questions. And they asked the prosecutors, this is a different person now, this is the appeals person, you know, what evidence did you have that Mr. Wilson did anything wrong here? right? And it was outrageous. This was caught in the media. The media was there too. There's overwhelming evidence. Is, you know, all these parents were bribing coaches, cheating on tests. You know, the judge said, no. What evidence is that Mr. Wilson did something wrong? What specific, you know, examples are?
Because this is your appeal, and you're the only defendant, right?
Right, and they were just smearing me with the bad acts of other people.
Yeah, okay.
That's the whole thing they did. Right, so it's just guilt by association. So no, what did Mr. Wilson do? And I said, oh, we have overwhelming evidence about Mr. Wilson, too. And the judge, for a third time, the judge, three times, just says, well, what specific examples can you give me that Wilson, that you have hard evidence that Mr. Wilson did something wrong? And you know what they said? It was crazy. They said, well, Mr. Wilson edited his son's essay, and that's not allowed, and he's the one who submitted the photos of his son, turned them part of their fake photos. And those two things are not allowed. Those are felonies because on the form, the college application, it says you did all this work yourself. You had no help from anybody else. And so the judge said, wait, don't most parents help their kids edit their essays? Yeah, but that's illegal. Like, what? So that was my crime, they said. That was the hard evidence they had, that I helped edit my son's essay. And I uploaded the photos because I had the photos on my camera. My son doesn't have photos of himself on his own iPhone. So I had photos of him in water polo in the pool. So I uploaded the photos directly to whatever website, whatever the thing was. Okay. So put me in jail, I guess. I uploaded the photos. And the judge said, what? Don't most parents do that? And so in the end, when they're forced to tell the truth to a judge who is reasonable, asking hard questions, the evidence they had was I edited my son's essay and I uploaded the photos. And they're supposed to be all done by my son. I didn't know that you signed some kind of statement at the bottom
who
of your application
that
you just... Who reads this stuff? And so, and even so, I think most people still help, and they get some of their high school counselors to help. They get all kinds of people to help and do stuff. So it's just kind of outrageous when the prosecutors had to say something that was truthful to these, appellate judges. They had nothing.
Wow. Mm.
And so the appellate judges threw it out?
They threw it out. They overturned all the convictions. All the corporate, except for one, which is the tax thing. Because on the tax thing, I did put it on the wrong line. They said, oh, Mr. Wilson's guilty of the tax thing. He deducted it on this line, and it shouldn't have been deductible at all because it was all a bribe. Wait a minute, the bribe was overturned, but under the tax law, you're not allowed to take a deduction if you got a benefit. And our guy said, well, the benefit is hard to quantify. It's not like you go to a dinner and you pay $1,000 for a fundraising dinner and you get a $50 steak meal and they deduct $50. And give you a donation receipt for $950. They gave him the receipt for whatever it was, $100,000 at USC, and I deducted that. And they said you weren't allowed to deduct that. And the judge just said, well, you put it on the wrong line at a minimum, so that is a felony. It's actually a fraud. If you put something on the wrong line in your tax return, you impede the IRS's ability to analyze your taxes. That's the quote I got. Okay, I didn't even read it. My taxes, by the way, I was living in Europe, working in Europe. I was paying taxes in Europe, I was paying taxes in the Netherlands, I was paying taxes in the U.S., and in California. My tax returns were over 250 pages long. I didn't read them. Maybe I should, that's bad, but, I was a busy executive. I didn't read them, I just signed them through DocuSign. And it didn't matter, because once you sign them, you're responsible for everything in it. So if you put something on the wrong line, that could be a felony.
Okay, that's...
And they got me for that. And I'm still fighting that piece.
Completely mental. We have to take one last break, and then when we come back, let's talk about USC, because they're involved in this as well, and so let's make sense of that a little bit. Okay, none of this makes any sense, though, John. Our guest is John Wilson. He is the author of Varsity Blues, The Scandal Within the Scandal. And just in case you already thought you knew what happened with this college admissions thing, yeah, by the way, you didn't. So, we will be right back. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teacher, leave them kids alone.
Best lead in for USC that I had. That's all I had. I didn't have Tusk. Sorry.
There you go.
So, how did they fit into this whole thing?
Well, USC, I think, is probably the most culpable in this whole process. We sued Netflix for defaming us, defamation, right. And we sued USC for defrauding us. Because, shockingly, we did our homework and we did our due diligence. When we were first donating, this is back in 2014, for my son, we didn't just donate to USC blindly through Singer. We actually went and did our due diligence. We met with the school. So my wife, my son, and I, we went down to USC before we made our donations to verify that donating through Singer's organization was fine. We met with the coach, the head coach. We also met with the development officer for athletics at USC. So we met with two different independent people to verify donating through Singer was fine. They said, yes, we've done this many times in the past. You make a donation, and that'll get you into the subco process, their subcommittee for admissions for athletes. And if you make a donation or a commitment for a donation, we'll review you through the subco. And subco has a much higher probability of admissions than the normal admissions process. We said, okay, great. And it's okay to donate through Singer's foundation? They said, yeah, we've done that in the past. Okay, no problem. So we verified that, and we verified with my son, he was there, with the coach, his credentials. So the coach asked him all kinds of questions about who his coaches were in high school, and he played for Stanford Club for 6 years, he said. Stanford Club is one of the top water polo teams in the country. That's well known. He was a starter there for years. He's one of the fastest players. He was always what they call the sprint-off player. So we went through all of this stuff with the USC people, and then after my son was accepted, we made our donation. They told us to make a donation after he was accepted. And then my son, we brought him to the water polo dorm or the water polo apartment. They had apartments for the water polo team. There was eight person apartment suites, four bedrooms with, two beds in each bedroom for the water polo kids who were the young red shirts. We brought him off to that dorm. We went to practices. We went throughout the entire season, went to games and everything else to watch my son. And so we did everything according to what the USC people told us. And then at my trial, the US people said, no, none of that was legal. This is all a bribe. I said, what? Yeah, you cannot get a boost in admissions for a donation. We said, that's not what you told us. So basically at the trial, if what they say is true, you have to accept what they say at the trial as being the truth, then they lied to us and defrauded us back in 2014. They said this was completely legitimate in 14. And then in 2019 at my trial, or actually 2021, rather, the trial was in 2021, they said, this is all abroad, this is not legal. I said, this is crazy. And so we learned of it then, and that's what we're saying to Netflix, that's what we're saying to USC. We filed suit in California. The judge has overruled us in the first hearing there. By the way, Netflix, we won their motion to dismiss, and we're going to trial. Now we're getting discovery, so that was good. We won in Superior Court in Massachusetts. In California, we lost the first round against USC. They're saying the statute of limitations should have started earlier. We say we didn't learn of this fraud until 2021. They're saying it should have happened when you were arrested in 2019.
How would you know? You should know
what you did was illegal. I said, we didn't know it was illegal. We didn't think they said you were on notice then because you were arrested for some reason. I said, yeah, I was arrested because they used me as a geographic pawn, not because I did anything wrong. But the judge, at least in the first phase of this, said, you must have known what you did was wrong. I said, no, I didn't. But we're appealing that one now. We're fighting that one through the appeals process. Again, more money, more time, and more resources than we have. Now, thank God that the work in case of both cases is being done on a contingent basis in large part. So don't have to spend much in the legal costs, moderate amounts now. But, fighting against three Goliaths at once is extremely frustrating and challenging in so many ways. It's not only a financial drain, but it's an emotional drain. And they keep hearing us. And USC still smears and says, your son wasn't qualified. You know, there's one bad email that I have from 2014. I was worried about my son fitting in on the team when Singer says, I say to my son, you know, is he going to get any playing time? He says, no, USC, are you kidding? The only freshman you get playing time are these monsters from Eastern Europe that Jovan, who's the Eastern European coach, he brings in all these ringers from Eastern Europe. That's how the team wins national championships. He brings in guys who are 25 years old as freshmen who haven't played, who've been playing water polo on club level, but haven't gone to college, and they qualify under NCAA rules if they haven't been to college yet to be a freshman. And I said, Jesus, how could my son, who's 17, hold the candle to these guys who are 25 from, you know, Serbia and, Hungary and Croatia, right? I say to him, is he going to be a leper? I said, is he going to be a leper? I was thinking about post-rate. Right? I said, are they going to, like, how's my guy going to be able, you know, he's a 7-year-old kid, and he's going to be 25-year-old military guys from Serbia. How's he going to fit in? Is he going to be, like, put in a corner? Is he going to be like a leper? I said that. Is he going to be a leper? And they said, oh, that's proof you knew your son wasn't qualified. No, they take it out of context. That's proof I was worried about him versus 25-year-old men from Eastern Europe. But he was highly qualified against kids his own age. So that's when we went to the school. As I told you, we did our due diligence. When we went to the school, met with the coach, we saw the team practicing, you know, 5 feet away from the pool's edge. We're standing by the pool's edge having our conversation. And we saw some of these older men, but we also saw some kids my son had played against in high school, you know, a year ahead of him. So we knew he could fit in just fine. It never came up again. But they go back to that email exchange from when my son was a junior in high school before we visited the team in person to say that was proof this was all fraud. They take things out of context like that. That was proof I was worried about my son fitting in socially with 25-year-old men from Eastern Europe. Yeah, but not that he wouldn't fit on the team as a player athletically against kids who are 19. So that's how they could run this whole process. And so we basically look at USC as being one of the most culpable because they defrauded us. They told us this is all how they did business. But we, in fact, had 100 examples of USC giving donor families a boost in admissions. But the judge disallowed all that evidence.
So yeah, because that had to happen a bunch of times. I mean, that's how they were doing it with everybody.
Yeah, exactly. It happened hundreds of times. We had examples of that. But the judge blocked all our evidence. Again, he blocked our evidence 660 times during the trial. And they said USC is not on trial here. It's the parents who are on trial. That's what the government kept saying. But USC was the one who was doing this all the time.
Yeah,
and they were raising millions and millions of dollars.
And they get to keep all the money.
And they got to keep all the money, right. And they never gave it back, and they gave me a receipt for it. And then they said at my trial, this is all a bribe.
But they gave you a receipt.
But they gave me a receipt, and they never gave it back. I never heard
John,
someone dealing
with a bribe.
What
I'm really
either.
Taking away from this is you're a terrible criminal. If you're,
yeah, they painted us out to be the worst of the worst.
You're just a terrible criminal. You're just bad at crime. It's a good thing that wasn't your life's ambition, because this... I mean, a lot of this?
Yeah, if we had criminal intent, why would we go to the school and
bring
the coaches and bring our son? Well, why would we go to games and practices?
Yeah.
We went to multiple games and practices.
And get receipts.
This wasn't fraud.
Come on.
And we got a receipt for our donation, right? We wouldn't do any of this
stuff. Checks. So, you wrote checks. Nobody writes checks if you're in crime, right? It's all crypto and whatever. What about these prosecutors?
Right.
Yeah, or cash. Yeah, cash is always good. Prosecutors, what, before we run out of time, are those? Did those people just get off scot-free? Are they still out there, you know, messing up other people's lives?
Oh, it's unbelievable. They gave themselves, there's about 20 prosecutors involved, 18 or 20 in the office. They gave themselves all these hero awards. It's unbelievable. They literally call themselves heroes. They gave this award they got from the Central DOJ office in D.C., commending them for their, you know, heroism and so forth. On the prosecutor's case, no one's above the law, all these platitudes. It's like, really? You know, maybe going after some of these parents for test cheating was a good thing to stop it, but to make that a felony and then to go after people like me and smear my innocent children, they gave those hero awards, and the top people have all left for million-dollar partner roles. At these firms, just like you think. That's what they do. They get a big national high-profile case. One of the guys who was in this thing had his own podcast talking about it. Said they'd gotten like 2 million hits on Google. This case had gotten like 2 million hits on Google. They were on the cover of I don't know, one of these like People magazine twice, and he's bragging about this stuff on his podcast. Right? It's like, really? So the publicity is what these guys crave, and gals crave, and it worked for them, right? It got them notoriety. And again, people did bad stuff. I'm not saying everybody should have gotten off scot-free.
Right.
There were people who were cheating on tests. People were bribing coaches. People were faking things left and right. And that's wrong. And should they be arrested? Probably. Maybe not. I don't know. Should have been a felony? Absolutely not, in my mind. But should have been this big national moment? You know, probably not. They were leveraging the Me Too movement, the anti-1% movement, you know, things like that. They were all going on in some of the different things happening. So, you know, at its core, this is a lot of wealthy parents who are being accused of abusing their privilege to help their unqualified kids bump you and you and you, all the parents listening, your children from being admitted to colleges. And that's unfair and it's wrong, and we ought to hold these guys accountable and put them in prison. Right? And that was the kind of mindset that was going on. It was almost like you could see people with pitchforks and torches running through the villages looking for me because it was that kind of, you know, hysteria that was being whipped up. And that's what they leveraged throughout this process for their own careers, and they did it quite successfully. These guys are smart. I mean, I'm not saying they weren't smart and good, but they were certainly very unethical the way they, you know, certainly prosecuted me in this case.
Wow.
So I gotta ask, how are your kids doing now?
They're still struggling. My poor daughters, you know, it's been devastating emotionally. You can imagine, you're 16 when you're being accused on a global scale by federal prosecutors of being unqualified. It's just devastating to your own psyche, your mental health and well-being, right? So it's been devastating.
Mm-hmm.
And my son, too, right? Your whole life has been in athletics, and the government calls you now a fake athlete. Right? And so now your close friends know you, and that's good. They support you. But you go beyond your circle of friends, immediate knowledge, and the internet and the trolls just destroy you. So you look for a job now, and you Google his name, and it still comes up as he was a fake athlete and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, so it's just, it's going to follow them forever. And the prosecutors know that, and they relish that. And they relish the fact they can destroy people's lives. Even after you win, there's a famous, you know, case of a secretary called Donovan. Where'd you go to get your reputation back?
Yeah, right. I was just going to say, and the retraction is on page, you know, 50.
Yeah, on the bottom of page 50 is a footnote when it's been headlines for years, you know, smearing you. So it's just the process is so despicable. And there's a lot of things that we're going to recommend that should be changed. And I'm going to do a second edition of the book. But we're working to do whatever we can to correct the record for our children and to help do what we can to make sure this doesn't happen to anybody else. Because if it can happen to me, it can happen to others.
Oh, sure.
And I'm sure it has happened to others. And I'm sure it will happen to others, but we want to do our fair share to make sure we can reduce that, because it's just wrong when our system can be abused this way.
Yeah. Well, that's not what people think that, you know, that's not what people think should be happening in our justice system.
Can you contact, or have you had any contact with the current administration, as the current DOJ, as far as writing what some of these prosecutors have done? Is there anything they can do for you?
Yeah, we're looking at that right now as we speak, actually. So that's one of the steps that we're taking as well, because we want to see changes in the system.
Sure.
You know, for example, there's some simple things. One thing that you may not know this, your audience may not know this, but no FBI interviews with any witnesses are ever recorded. It's a policy.
Wow.
And there was a big phone call made to us in this case that was made from the FBI's own offices by Rick Singer that was never recorded. It's like, what? So this is kind of a crazy policy. They only write down their notes, called 302 notes, after they've had a conversation, and they do it from memory. And so that way they can actually twist the truth to fit the narrative they want.
Sure.
So the whole process is a bit backwards. So we want to recommend, this has been recommended in the past, and the government has fought it tooth and nail, that every interaction with every witness should be recorded. Just like the, you know, some of the Rodney King and other events forced changes in the street cops to wear body cameras.
Sure.
The equivalent for the FBI and prosecutors is every interview ought to be recorded. They ought to press the record button on their phone. Right? It's easy to do. They have devices everywhere all the time. Every interview ought to be recorded. That would stop a lot of stuff they did. They said in my case, for example, they never recorded or wrote down anything that was exculpatory. It's like, what? You can't do that. That's not allowed in the rules. That's what they said. If we didn't write down anything that was exculpatory. So, for example, there was a one-hour call or a 34-minute call. It was extremely helpful. They didn't record it. And all they had with their notes was seven words. Good first call with Wilson Daughters. That's what they write, right? So they hide all the evidence that way. It's like, really?
I'm surprised.
So we're going to recommend things like requiring all these things to be recorded. Now, in the past, I guess Robert Mueller is the one who opposed this vehemently, whatever it was, 15 years ago, that there was a recommendation to record. And he said, no, it would impede the FBI's ability to investigate and blah, 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 blah.
Oh, my God.
Impede, just hold them accountable.
John, we are doomed by the clock. The clock has us.
Okay.
But we're going to do this again because this was really interesting.
We put your book on our website, Varsity Blues, The Scandal Within the Scandal.
At
wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, it's been nice chatting with you. Thank you.
Thanks.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.